everyone. This is the podcast for the Orfila Center's Structural Violence, Police and Prison Abolition and Decoloniality Research Cluster. In this series, we feature the compelling works of different scholars and activists whose research touches upon violence, marginalization, and carcerality. Today, we're going to talk to Salma Shesh. Salma Shesh is a PhD student in the Department of History at UCSB. She studies the modern Middle East with a focus on gender and criminality in the late 19th century and early 20th century in Egypt. Before coming to UCSB, she worked at Nazra for Feminist Studies, a feminist Egyptian collective, between 2016 and 2019. She holds a master's degree in Middle East politics from SOAS, University of London. She is among the founding members of the Bread and Freedom Party in Egypt. Thank you so much, Salma, for joining and agreeing to talk to us and share your research with us today.
Thank you, Bihit. I'm so excited to be
Thank with you. Can you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your research interests, and your trajectory? I know that your MA research was also focused on policing practices in Egypt. Can you tell us more about that and how it may have guided your steps towards further research on these issues?
Yes, sure. I'm not sure I have a lot to add about myself to the introduction that you gave, which has really everything, but as you said, I'm a third year PhD student in the history department here at UCSB, and I work with Professor Shireen Salkhadi on policing, criminality, and incarceration in late 19th and early 20th century Egypt. I'm not sure how to describe my trajectory, but whatever my trajectory is, I think it was defined by the 25th of January revolution in Egypt, and I know this is now maybe cheesy and cliche to say, but it is the truth. My research interests and my political commitments stem from that moment where revolution was possible and where, you know, my world just suddenly became bigger, much wider, like the worlds of many women and men during the revolution, especially those who were like me back then in their late teens and still defining their research interests and themselves. And it's in the years after 2011 that I began to be interested in policing and incarceration. I think the past 11 years after the revolution, but especially also the past 6 years or so, have become so defined by detention, imprisonment, sentencing, the reality of it, the possibility of it. So many activists who were part of the revolution are now in prison. So many colleagues and friends are in prison or have been in prison. So to me, research interests and political commitments are not unrelated. They're very, very much related. So this is where my interest in incarceration and policing comes from. From that lived reality in the past decade or so since I became interested or engaged in political work or in the public sphere in a way. And, you know, police violence was one of the most important triggers of the uprising in 2011. The 25th of January was Police Day. The 28th of January, arguably the most important day of the revolution, was the battle of protesters against the police, after which the police retreated for a while. So I think for anyone who was inspired by the revolution or who took part in some protests, the police or policing are such central parts of what we need to understand. Because you mentioned the MA thesis, I especially became interested in the question of why police brutality and why certain patterns of police violence, like torture in places of detention or the excessive use of arms by the police in random situations, really. Why have these patterns of violence remained so consistent, even in the midst of political turmoil and with the changes of heads of states and the fall of someone like Habib al-Adli after the revolution, who was really considered, you know, one of the most important symbols of that violence? And I was not under any illusion that the regime has fell in when I was doing my master's back in 2014. At SOAS, but I was really interested in why certain patterns of police violence have changed, like policing public protests, for example, and why certain patterns have remained so consistent despite the upheaval and the political turmoil in the country. So my MA thesis is really about understanding violence, police brutality as a bureaucratic practice, as part of routine bureaucracy in a sense. But once I finished writing my thesis, my master's thesis, I became so convinced that it is crucial to historicize this, right? To understand where the roots of policing and the structure of prisons come from. What is the longer history of that institution? And it's really not possible to understand current trends of policing or of incarceration in Egypt and elsewhere without understanding what happened before. And in Egypt especially, it is important to understand the reforms in the criminal justice system more broadly that happened in Egypt in the 19th century, especially between the 1820s and 1870s. And to also understand current policing practices is also entangled with the history of colonialism in Egypt, things like the militarization of the police, for instance. So it is, I've become so convinced that the history of that institution is just so crucial in understanding our current realities and understanding the present. Not to be cliche again and mention Foucault when we talk about prisons, but you know how in Discipline and Punish, she says that any history of the prison is a history of the present. And I really feel that very much in the case of Egypt and I think the case of any other place or region as well. So yeah, this is what this history is to me. It is very much a history of the present, a history that is so entangled with our current realities.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I agree completely. I think it's really important that we have someone like you who's tackling this from like a historical perspective and like contextualizing our present. So I wanted to also ask if you could share with us any like interesting part of your research that you've come across, or anything like unexpected or very telling about imprisonment and carcerality in the Middle East.
Yes. So for the past 2 years, I've been mostly working on the case of two very, very famous or infamous Egyptian serial killers. I'm sure you know them, as I think anyone who grew up in Egypt might know them, Raya Ouskina, who are two sisters who murdered 17 women or participated in the murder of 17 women between 1919 and 1920 in Alexandria. They are, I think, the most famous serial killers in modern Egyptian history, and they were the first women to receive the death sentence in modern Egypt. So their case is so famous, and I think their memory is almost inescapable in Egypt. So many films, so many series, so many popular culture references to Raya and Sakina that, you know, everyone who grows up in Egypt sort of knows who they are. They were the protagonists of my own childhood nightmares. And so when I started my PhD, I came across Salah Issa's book, Rigel Raya Ouskina, about the case. And then I read Nefertiti Douglas' dissertation about them, and I was so surprised about how much was erased from the public memory of these criminals. And so I was able to access the court record because it was housed in the National Center for Judicial Studies, which was much easier to access than the National Archives. And I began to work on the court record, and I was so fascinated by how much about this case was about things other than murder, right? How much about constructing Raya and Sakina as these extraordinary criminals, these monsters, was not necessarily about the murders. Of course, the murders were an important part of that. It is what triggered the arrest and the sentencing. But a lot of the sensation that happened in the popular press and in the court when Raya and Sakina were arrested was about something other than the murders. So I did not know before reading these second resources and then accessing the court record that Raya and Sakina were not only serial killers, but that they were brothel owners. They owned several brothels in Alexandria before they started murdering women. And I didn't know that the women they killed were actually, most of them were actually their friends and sex workers who worked in these brothels. And this is something that's erased from all of the popular culture renditions about their stories, except maybe for the 2006 TV series. And also, I was very struck by the, you know, quote-unquote detail that actually they were accomplices in the murders. It is the men, their husbands, and two other men at least, who killed, who were killing the women. And Raya and Sakina were mostly responsible for getting the women home, getting the cheap alcohol that would get them drunk. Sometimes they would observe the murders or were present during the murders. But they were made into the, you know, criminal masterminds behind this case of serial murder. So these extraordinary criminals. And I was very struck by that archival encounter. You know, as I got acquainted with their court record, my expectation to sort of find thrill on every page, you know, juicy details of murder, was sort of confronted by the banality, the mundanity of their everyday lives. The question for me became not only why and how Raya and Sakina became extraordinary figures, but what was banal, what was ordinary about their lives as women. And, you know, their case, I think, reveals a moment where certain modes of being, certain modes of personhood that might have been ordinary or banal at some point were becoming not only marginal, but impossible and un-Egyptian. So if you read the coverage of the popular press of Raya and Sakina's case, when they were arrested until they were executed, you will see that the press was so concerned with their involvement in sex work and was so concerned with their sexualities that it was, you know, that their sexualities was more incriminating than the murders. And you see how sex work, and, you know, it's important to take into account that these crimes, these murders happened in a very critical moment in Egyptian history, right? From 1919 to 1921, you know, that's a timeline where Egypt was in the midst of nationalist upheaval. The identity of the independent Egyptian nation was being shaped and formed. And Egyptian womanhood was such an important part of that, as many, many feminist scholars have taught us, right, that this new Egyptian woman, emblematic of the new Egyptian nation, was supposed to be educated, was supposed to be patriotic, was supposed to be respectable. And Raya and Sakina stood in stark contrast to all of that. But I think it is so important to read their case, not only as just a mere antithesis to ideal womanhood, but what might we learn if we listen to them, if we read their lives as the lives of ordinary criminals? And I think they tell us so much about sexual subcultures that existed in Egypt and that continue to exist, and that were becoming, at a certain moment in that very, very critical juncture in 1919, were becoming not just subaltern, not just marginal, but were becoming unthinkable, un-Egyptian, excluded from the definition of Egyptianness. And that in this sense, there was a sort of a cultural circulation of the case of Raya and Sakina as an indignation to the nation, right? A crime against the nation, not necessarily a crime against the 17 women who were murdered. This is why the women, Raya and Sakina, became so central in that story, more than the men who actually committed the murders, because it was a very, very gendered story. You know, the case was called Adeyat Raya Sakina, the case of Raya Sakina, in these popular press coverages, rather than, I don't know, the serial murder of Alexandria or the Alexandria gang or something else, right? The women became so central. So I think even though it's not a story about incarceration per se, but I think it tells us so much about criminality and criminal justice. And what really changed my way of thinking about research and about imprisonment and policing in the case of Raya and Sakina is that this is a case about serial murder, but that court record can be a site for a different kind of memory. It can be a window into lives that have been erased and criminalized. It's a window into that world. And I think the historian can use this archival record as the site of a different public memory than the one of murder, deviance, and monstrosity. And I'm not trying to say that Faye and Sakina were not serial killers. They were part of these murders, for sure. But just trying to uncover what else was there in this story, what made the story so sensational, and what was, in fact, not that sensational, not that extraordinary about it. So I think their case made me much more interested for like my future work for my dissertation, in less in institutions, because I was very, very focused on the history of institutions, right? The history of the police as an institution or of the prison as an institution. And it became much more about the criminals to me. What might we learn if we center the criminal rather than the institution? Too often, crime and criminality appear as self-evident or normative categories in some scholarship about carcerality or policing. But if we center criminals not as a pre-social category, but as a socio-legal and bureaucratic process that is always under construction and negotiation, we might learn so much more about prisons, about carcerality, and about policing if we center those criminals who tell us so much about these institutions, but also tell us so much about subaltern lives and worlds that have been either criminalized or erased from public memory or the historical record, have become Egyptian non-histories in a sense. So yeah, sorry, that was a very long answer to your question.
That was an amazing answer. Thank you so much. And this is really interesting. And like, I personally didn't know a lot of this. I know it's like a popular story, but I never knew, for example, that the men were more complicit in the murders, or they actually did the murders. I don't even know the names of their husbands. So that in itself is telling. So thank you so much.
Because Raya and Skina always, appear in these popular culture renditions as the criminal masterminds, and their husbands as subordinate, right? As just listening to whatever these women had to say. So it was very fascinating to see that, you know, this was not necessarily the case, and to also see that sex work was such an important part of that story that just became completely forgotten and erased in most of the subsequent popular adaptations of the story. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, don't apologize. This is like so interesting, and I think it's very relevant, especially because the story, like, it lives on. So I think it's really important, this idea of like reading against the grain, the archival grain. So going back to this idea of carcerality and thinking about carcerality in the Middle East, I know that you worked with Professor Shireen Saikali on a syllabus titled Carcerality in the Middle East, right? Can you tell us a little bit about your thought process in the creation of that syllabus, and what you were keen on adding to the syllabus, how you connected the readings, and how the experience of the class has been so far? What were your main takeaways, and like, what have you been really enjoying reading in that class or learning from in that class?
This is a graduate seminar that Professor Saikali is teaching this quarter, and she was very generous to ask for my input, it has been really, really useful and enjoyable to just like think together about what to include in that syllabus and what is this class really about, you know. And I think to answer your question, I think there were maybe two or three things that were very important in our thinking when we were writing or when we were putting together the syllabus. And it's really a Professor Saikali's syllabus, but I just helped with some of the suggestions and the readings and so on. And I think one of the things, the assumptions that we didn't want to start with was the assumption that incarcerated bodies or prisons are somehow inaccessible, hidden, or marginal, and rather start with the assumption that we could center incarcerated bodies in modern Middle East history. So what do we learn if we center incarcerated bodies rather than seeing them as inaccessible, exceptional, or marginal? What do we learn if we actually think of the prison not as marginal to the geography or architecture of modern Middle Eastern states, but as actually very central and actually very visible and actually somehow accessible. So that was sort of the first conceptual question. And then the second was to not only be concerned with understanding the logics and the history of how prisons came to exist, right? The understanding incarceration is not how incarceration became the main tool of punishment is not the only goal of this seminar. Incarceration is only the end for the incarcerator, but for the incarcerated, it generates new meanings. And so these new meanings, trauma, loss, community, bodily marks, identity, new identities is part of what we're really concerned with in this class. And I'm reading a lot of readings that are concerned with these questions. What meanings does the experience of incarceration generate for the incarcerated? And we're thinking about these meanings together in different historical contexts in the modern Middle East, in colonial contexts, in nationalist contexts, in revolutionary contexts. And then the third thing also that was very important for us was to imagine the possibility of abolition from the onset. So we started the class with Ruth Wilson Gilmore's Golden Gulag, even though it's obviously not about the Middle East, but we think it is very relevant and it does also speak to our realities, and that we have to be in conversation with scholars of abolition and scholars of prison elsewhere. So also imagining abolition alongside the history of imprisonment has been very important to us. I think Professor Sarkali, not only in this class, but also in other graph classes that I've taken with her, always not only includes works by historians in history classes, but also by anthropologists, sociologists, political scientists. And I think that's really rich, that interdisciplinary take on how we do history. One other thing that we were very keen on in syllabus is to read something about the present with every quote-unquote historical book that we're reading, that not seeing the past and the present as is connected. So every week we read a scholarly monograph, but we also either listen to a podcast episode, an interview, we look at a work of art, we read a short newspaper or magazine article, or a testimony from a former prisoner. And so That is from the present. So putting the history of incarceration in conversation with the present and current realities of imprisonment in the region has been also so important to us, and putting other forms of cultural and knowledge production in conversation with what is usually labeled as scholarly monographs has also been very important. So looking at works of art, listening to podcasts, that has also been really important. In terms of my takeaways or what has been interesting to read in class, I have so many takeaways, it's really difficult to sort of summarize them, but I maybe want to talk about one particular monograph that really, really impacted me, which was about Syrian prison literature. It's Sharia Talirani's book, Readings in Syrian Prison Literature, The Poetics of Human Rights. And I think this book just opened so many possibilities for us to think about imprisonment and what imprisonment might teach us, and how do we read about what sources do we look for when we want to learn about prisons in the Middle East? And of course, it's a book about prison literature, so literature constitutes most of these sources. But even then, literature, what does literature mean? You know, the short story, the poems, the novels, the memoirs, what kind of writings are writings? What kind of writings are prison writings? All of these questions, I think, opened so many methodological and theoretical possibilities for me to think about the prison, and also really points to the idea that prison writers or prison in general, the book is about political imprisonment. So political prisoners don't only challenge political regimes, but they also in their writings and in their existence challenge meanings of, you know, what does human suffering mean? What does torture mean? What does pain mean? What does being human itself mean? So I think this was a very, very different and rich book also in that it centers the actual prisoners. So even though I work on something very different in a very different historical period and in a different country, but the methodological and theoretical tools that she uses in the book have just opened a lot of new questions and new possibilities for me, and I think for others as well.
Thank you so much, Salma. I think that's very powerful, and I think the syllabus in the class itself is very, very powerful, and I think it's a good blueprint for, you know, other classes and like anyone who wants to do research on similar themes. I think one of the really interesting things about your work is these connections between research, pedagogy, and activism, and I know that you kind of see academic work as also a form of like a political commitment, as you said earlier. So I wanted to also ask you about your political and activist work in Egypt. I know you've worked for Nazra, and that you, as mentioned in your bio, were one of the founders of the Bread and Freedom Party. Can you tell us more about how your work intersects, like how this work in Egypt intersects with your research work?
Yes, I really think that my research interests, or what I hope to do or write about, is not only intersecting with but directly emerging from the realities of politics and organizing in Egypt. And you know, in the past years, we've had so many colleagues and friends in the party and from also other circles arrested or sentenced to very harsh sentences or detained in really miserable conditions. So I, you know, really hope to be attempting to do some research that helps to understand the history and the legacies of policing and incarceration in Egypt. And, you know, more so also than the specific topics, how the topics intersect with activism, but also how do we write histories that are accessible and meaningful to the communities and the people we write about and care about. So I'm also very concerned with the question of where to publish, how to publish, and how to create conversations around these histories that are, you know, go beyond academic circles. Academic conversations are very important and very, you know, constructive, and it's the heart of what we do. But I'm also very concerned with how to make these conversations also part of other circles, whether activist circles or just maybe broader public in Egypt. So, and how to learn from the people I work with beyond academia. So, you know, my colleagues in party, my feminist colleagues, how to make sure that I am also in conversation with them, not only in conversation with historians or scholars.
I know that, like, as you mentioned earlier, the work kind of feeds into each other, like the questions research-wise also are informed by your experiences in that political work. So I think that's very interesting. So these were kind of the main questions I had. So just to kind of conclude, like, I wanted to ask you if there's anything else that you wanted to add, or if there's something that I haven't asked about that you think is important for thinking through carcerality and imprisonment. Yeah, if there's anything else you would like to add that I missed or...
No, I don't think so. I think this was a very rich conversation, and your questions were really also useful for me to help me think through what I'm actually interested in and why I care about this work. So thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I hope that the work that we do will be meaningful for the communities and the people we care about.
Yes, thank you so much. And, you know, thank you for sharing all this knowledge with us.
Thank you so much.